Call the Hess meeting to order. It is March 6th, and it is about 2 minutes after 3. And just want to introduce our members. We have Representative Fairclough, Representative Seaton, Representative Roses, and myself, Representative Wilson. And our secretary is Kelly Burnett. And our moderator is Don Finley Groves, right? And so what we're going to do today, our order of business, we're going to hear House Bill 148, which is our senior care. And then we're going to have House Bill 136, the dental hygienist. And then we're going to go to House Bill 149, stillbirth certificates, in that order. And I hope that we have time to do them all, but we'll see what happens. So Commissioner, why don't you come forward? And we have Senate Bill 148, senior care. And if you would explain to us, this is a department bill. And so if you will explain to us your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Carlene Jackson, Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services. And I'm pleased to be here today to present Governor Palin's proposed legislation for the Alaska Senior Care Program. I've also got several staff members that can answer detailed questions should those come up. For those that may not know about this program, Senior Care Program helps low-income seniors in Alaska by providing cash assistance of $120 a month currently, or a prescription drug subsidy for Medicare Part D. And the senior program at this point is due to sunset on June 30th of this year. Currently, more than 7,000 seniors use the program. That's about 15% of the state senior population, which demonstrates the need for the program. This bill proposes legislation to improve the program and extend the senior care program for another 5 years. And the changes to senior care will help keep it more effective and simplify the administration of the program. And that includes updating the income limit for eligibility and eliminating the prescription drug assistance program. Currently, the senior care program eligibility threshold is frozen at 135% of the 2005 federal poverty level. And that doesn't reflect the reality of rising costs. We've talked in other versions of this committee about what that does to eligibility. The annually adjusted federal poverty level for Alaska would be used to keep pace with the rising cost of living in this legislation. By tying senior care eligibility to the current federal poverty rates and updating it each year, those modest cost of living adjustments would happen for seniors' income, so that Social Security, for example, wouldn't nudge them over the income limit, which was a problem we had with eligibility in the past. The change would raise eligibility levels only modestly. At the 2007 poverty level, the senior care income level would rise to $17,240 for a single individual, compared to the current rate of $16,133, and $23,112 for a couple, compared to a couple currently at $17,240. The liquid assets of seniors would be allowed to hold the same as they are, $6,000 for an individual and $9,000 for a couple. And the prescription drug subsidy would be dropped. We currently only have 140 seniors that are using that aspect of the program, and a survey has shown that most of them have other options for prescription drugs, and so this would help to simplify the administration of the program as well. So in a nutshell, that's kind of the overview of the bill. We also have a fiscal note, and we've got our Assistant Commissioner for Finance and Management that can speak to that if you would like us to go over that in detail, or we can entertain questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I know I've had seniors call me with concerns that when their Social Security cost of living went up, they missed it by, and they were getting it, and then they missed it by $11. And that really did put a hardship on them. So I'm real glad to see this. I saw a hand come up here. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I had was on page 2, line 7, where we talk about the annual poverty guidelines for Alaska. Are those annual federal poverty guidelines published in a timely enough fashion so that it can be integrated into the application, or do we want the annual federal poverty guidelines for the previous year, so that they're known.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, with the committee's indulgence, I'll invite Ellie Fitzgerald, who's our public assistance director, forward to give you details. But those are published annually, and I believe that she'll be able to reassure you about that point.
Good afternoon. My name is Ellie Fitzgerald, director for the Division of Public Assistance. Representative Seaton, through the chair, those annual poverty guidelines are published the beginning of each calendar year. So traditionally, historically, they've been published around February 15th. This year, they were published a little bit earlier. So we implement those just as soon as we can after they've been published and take place for Alaska. So that applicants each year as they apply, we would be applying those income levels to seniors who are applying for the program or going through a renewal process for the program.
Okay, follow-up, Representative Seaton.
And the renewal time, or how does that correspond with this? I mean, is that on their birthday, basically, or when they're eligible because of 65, or is that renewal program, do you get these instituted early enough so that everybody applying in the year is going to be treated equally, or do we have people that are going to apply in January that their eligibility status is going to be different than somebody that applies in March because of the poverty guideline may change within that same calendar year?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the renewal process works from the date that they apply. So a senior who applies today in March would go through a renewal process next March, and their income eligibility and their eligibility for the program would continue from now until next March unless there had been a change in their income, and they report that to us. When there's a change in their income, then we redetermine their eligibility. So it's really a monthly determination, although most of our seniors have very stable income and we don't see a lot of fluctuation in that from the point that they apply until the renewal. Now, it would work next March that if somebody came in and applied, we would apply the 2008 standards to them if we had them at the time. If we didn't, then there could be, if they're right on the cusp of eligibility, there could be some seniors that might not be eligible the month that they apply, but be eligible in a future month once those standards take effect.
Just one second. Let the record show that Representative Gardner and Representative Sisna has joined us. And go ahead, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. So if someone applies in January and they miss the eligibility guidelines, do you hold that application as an application, even though it would have been denied because they missed the eligibility till February or March? And when that is published, would you automatically then qualify them, or do they have to go through the application process again?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we would deny their application, and if their income was that close to the guideline, we would tell them that when those guidelines increase, that they may qualify. I meant to reapply at that time.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
I have a question, Ellie. How do you do it for the state budget? Because our budget year is from July to July, and so how does that work when in the middle of the year that increases? We still give the same amount, or how does that work?
Representative Wilson, we do provide the same amount of benefit. It's a flat amount every month. It's not based on the amount of income that you have. So if you qualify for $120 per month. And the way we calculate that with our budget is we look at our historical caseload over the course of the year. Every month we have new seniors coming off, we have some moving out of state or passing away, and so we look at what the average is over the course of the year and estimate our budget that way.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Guess not. Thank you. Anyone else that wants to testify? Okay, we have Mike Ford. Come on up, Mike.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mike Ford. I'm here today on behalf of the Alaska Native Health Board. We're here today just to voice our support for the bill. We believe this is an important part of low-income seniors' monthly incomes. And I've reviewed the bill. I think it's, I really applaud you for bringing it up in a timely manner. And we'd like to see this, of course, move through the system. The only recommendation I would have for your consideration, I know that we're adding another sunset date. Of course, the legislature can always review programs at their own, as their own schedule. If you would consider removing the sunset date, of course, that would be something we would support. But I understand that there is this political process that likes to have sunset dates that bring the bill back for your consideration. But aside from that issue, we're completely supportive of the bill. And thank you for bringing it up and hope to see it move quickly.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. See any questions. Thank you very much. Off net, do we have Herb Simon? Herb, are you there?
Oh, yes, ma'am.
State your name and affiliation, and then give us your testimony.
Okay, my name's Herb Simon from Nalchina, no affiliation. I'm glad to see the revival of this, or the extension of this senior care program. It helps a lot. And the only question I would have is this poverty level deal. I don't understand that. That's established by the federal government or us?
Well, it's established by the federal government, and then we decide what percentage of that we're going to accept and where we're going to put our line of income.
I see. Well, my only comment on that would be, first of all, thank you, and my comment on that would be that federal employees in the state of Alaska draw a 25% COLA because of, and that's before all this deal went on about high price of fuel, and now we've been into this fuel situation long enough that it's rippled down into just about every commodity that everybody uses. And it appears to me that that's quite a gulf between the formula that we use for determining eligibility for this and what the federal standard is.
Yeah, I think that's why we went up to 135% instead of just 100%.
I see. And now that went up, ma'am, 35% in this bill. What was it in the old law?
I think we just had an amount. I'm not sure about that. We'll have somebody come up and talk about it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, yes.
It was told to us. It was froze at 135 at the 2005 level, and what we've done is release the 2005 so that it can escalate with cost of living at the federal government. So it's 135 now based on the federal government rate, but not froze at the 2005 poverty level number for the 135%.
And Herb, did you understand that?
No.
Well, we've changed it now, so as the federal poverty guidelines go up, so will this.
I see.
So that's kind of putting a protection in there, so the same thing won't happen that happened this year, because some people missed it when that happened. Some people missed it by $11.
Yes, ma'am. I heard your comment on that previously.
So we're hopefully, as things change and that increases, our line that we draw will also rise with that, and it will stay 135% of the federal guidelines.
Okay. Another comment I'd have, ma'am, is that, you know, one size fits all doesn't really, it might apply down in the lower 48, but for example, the cost of living of people living in kind of remote areas or out of the big towns like Fairbanks and Anchorage, you know, the same commodities that you can buy in the big cities run, you know, 15% to 25% higher outside. And these are things that are necessities of life, like fuel oil and things of that nature. So anyway, I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I encourage you folks to move this bill along, because it's really needed, especially up here in the remote areas.
Okay. Thank you very much, Herb.
Thank you, ma'am.
Pat Luby,
afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pat Luby. I'm the Advocacy Director for AARP in Alaska. AARP supports Governor Palin's bill, HB 148, which would reauthorize the senior care program. We're particularly pleased that the governor is bringing annual indexing of the program based on increases in the federal poverty level. And Alaska actually does have a higher federal poverty level. Alaska and Hawaii are the only ones that differ from the other 48, and Alaska is the highest. We don't think that any senior care participant should be eliminated from the program simply because of inflation, over which they have no control, and the governor's bill will handle that now. As you mentioned in our letter of support to the committee, there's three areas the legislature might want to consider. The first one is the assets test. Many low-income older people still try to save money each month, usually trying to save for health care costs. The current limit, and the one in the governor's bill, limits liquid assets to $6,000 for a single and $9,000 for a couple. That's really very, very low. And what you find is that many older people will try to save money, and they may miss the program, even though they need it, simply because they're trying to save for the future. But the governor also leaves the stipend at $120 monthly. I know there has been discussion with some legislators about trying to increase that to at least $150 monthly, and we would certainly encourage you to look at that. There's also that 140 people that the commissioner mentioned who were between 135 and 175% of the federal poverty level. They did not get the monthly stipend, but they did get their Medicare Part D deductible as well as the monthly premiums paid under the program previously. Those people won't have that coverage. If the assets test was liberalized, it might be possible that some of those people would actually qualify for senior care and qualify then for the monthly check. That would certainly be welcome for those folks. But overall, we're very pleased that the governor has brought this bill forward, and we certainly encourage your committee to move it forward with an aye vote. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Pat. Is there anyone else online that wants to testify? Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify? Okay, I'm closing testimony then. And we will, Representative Seaton.
Madam Chair, could we get the department back? Yep. Did have another question.
Commissioner, can you come forward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the fiscal note, I notice it's about $5 million a year, and then in the last year on this page, it jumps to over $12 million a year. Could you just explain that jump?
And Madam Chair, with your indulgence, I will let our Assistant Commissioner for Finance explain that.
Okay, Janet.
Good afternoon. For the record, Janet Clark with the Department of Health and Social Services. Representative Seaton, through the chair. The reason the fiscal note is written the way it is the five-year sunset provision in the legislation. So after 2012, the program would sunset. So we show all the funds being eliminated at that point because it would need to be reauthorized.
Representative Seaton?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I guess I'm not understanding. Looking across here at the operating or the GF, they're all listed as negatives, including the $10 million from GF. What? Am I just misreading the fiscal note that the parentheses in 2010 and 2013 are the same?
Right. Again, through the chair, Representative Seaton, in doing this fiscal note, it was a little confusing, but let me try to help explain. Currently, in the governor's budget and the governor's original budget, there was a budget of $10.6 million of general funds available for the senior care program. So, FY 2008, based on our estimate and our assumptions outlined in the fiscal note, particularly the provision that states that if the longevity bonus is reinstated, you can't get both benefits. You could only choose one. We would see a savings in fiscal year 2008. Then you see that the savings So that's comparing to the governor's budget. And we've checked the box that said, mark this box if funding for this bill is included in the governor's 2008 budget proposal. So that box is checked. So all of the numbers here compare to that current budget of $2.6 million. So there's a negative almost $3 million in FY 2008 because of all the assumptions outlined in the fiscal note, primarily the one relating to the longevity bonus and not having individuals get those benefits twice. Then in fiscal year 2009, there still is a negative. It's not cumulative, it's independent. So one way we talked about doing the fiscal note, but worked with the governor's Office of Management and Budget, and they suggested we put it in this format, you actually see that the reduction is less. So in 2009, we're going to spend a little bit more. 2010, the reduction is a little bit less. We're going to spend a little bit more. And I'm just comparing the GF line. The same thing until we get to after 2012, then my explanation that the program sunsets and we take all the money that's out of the budget at that point. So it is a bit confusing because we're comparing to the money that's currently in the budget and showing a reflection of that comparison. The other dollar amount there, the senior care fund, there were appropriations into the senior care fund, and the way it worked was kind of like the Marine Highway Fund. And last year the legislature changed how that was working because it was too confusing. General funds were appropriated into the senior care fund, and then we spent out of the senior care fund. So the money that the authorization that's in the senior care fund, there is no money that backs that up. So we're just reducing that budget authority out of the budget in the fiscal note. So I apologize that it is a bit confusing.
Representative Roses?
I have to admit it is confusing. I can understand where you would have a decrease in the 2008 budget because you have a proposed budget out there that we saw when we first got down here, and now that's been adjusted. But I didn't realize we had budgets set for all the way up to 2012. So I could see it as a decrease for this year, but I don't see how it can be a decrease for a budget that you haven't already put together. That's the confusing part for me.
It is confusing, and I think that there was some discussion about how to portray the fiscal note, and we went with the advice that was given by the governor's Office of Management and Budget.
As a follow-up, if I might.
Follow-up, Representative.
So what I hear you saying is if we took the budget that we started with before we had the amendments, and if you took that same line item and you projected that same number out all the way to 2012, that then this is what the reductions would be as a result of not issuing a longevity check, but instead issuing this assistance payment.
Perhaps if we went over the assumptions, it might be easier to then back into the actual fiscal note.
Yeah. I saw part of that, but yeah. I realize there's a change in those that qualify and don't qualify, but I guess I made the point. I mean, it's confusing to me how you show a budget decrease when we don't have a budget, but that's okay.
Well, actually, because usually what stays in once it's in the budget, it's there.
Right. But through the chair, Representative Roses, I've seen many versions of how in the past. There is no one way to describe this. The legislature's shown it differently. I've seen it in the past where the whole budget for senior care was taken out of the budget and everything was put in a fiscal note. And that might be the simplest way to do it. And that might, in my discussions with Representative Hawker, that might be the way we end up doing it, frankly. But I think if we talk about the assumptions, what we're going to make sure is that whatever the final budget is, the fiscal note, is consistent with the assumptions. So we're watching the numbers very closely.
That's fine.
And I have, Janet, from the way I understand it is probably there will be a reduction in this because obviously if there would be a longevity bonus, people would pick that over this because that gives them more.
Madam Chairman, yes, some people might choose that. route. Some individuals under longevity bonus would receive only a $100 payment per month, and they might choose senior care.
Gotcha.
One of our assumptions that we outline in the fiscal note is that we assume an individual will choose the higher dollar amount, and that's the assumptions we went with.
Okay. Representative Fairclough?
We had a testimony that referred to an asset limit, and I've been trying to find it in here. Can you give me a citation for the asset limit? It's not directly spoken to in the bill, though there might be number, a statute number, but I've went all the way through 4745330, and I can't find it.
If our folks in the either Ellie Fitzgerald or our Department of Law attorney, Stacey Crayley, they might have it. If they don't, we'll have to get back to you on that.
Okay.
They're scrambling back there with papers.
Yep, we can go ahead for something
we'll have
else.
To, okay. We'll have to look for that and get back
Thank
to you.
You.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I would, you know, I have a difficulty with looking at this fiscal statement or fiscal note contemplating the passage of a separate piece of legislation. And I think that we never do that because we never know what's going to pass. And so this really does not give us a clear picture of what this legislation does. This gives us a picture of what this legislation would do if another piece of legislation might pass. And so, you know, I don't know what the numbers are for this piece of legislation. And so it's... I would really like to see this analyzed as the bill that it is, not contingent upon some other bill passing or the price of oil going to $100 a barrel or anything else. I mean, we have a piece of legislation here that needs to be analyzed on its own.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, at the time of the start of the legislative session, I think there was an understanding that the longevity bonus could be reinstated as a budget item without legislation. Subsequent to that, we've learned through the Legislative Council and Department of Law that the reinstatement of the longevity bonus indeed requires legislation. So the timing and the decision making, I think if you look back, seemed appropriate at the time, but certainly we've learned a lot more now where we are. Page 2 of the fiscal note, and I think a comparison chart, does tell you the cost of this legislation. And again, it has to do with how we're comparing it. So the FY08 cost of this legislation, and again, it does assume, we do base it on the assumption that the longevity bonus is reinstated, would cost $7,257,600. So that's based on that assumption plus several others that we outline above, in addition to the change in the poverty level guideline. At anyone's request, we provided information to a number of individuals. We can do the same comparison with or without the longevity bonus to give you the right dollar amount or any information as it works its way through the system.
Yeah, Madam Chair,
follow-up,
I just request that we get that analysis. You know, my concern is that we've now been, you know, everything is progressing, and we've now been given a financial outlook that we could be looking at deficits in the year 2009 or 2010. The problem is that if we establish a $30 million longevity bonus program and then we're running deficits, those funds would be subtracted out, probably half of it, out of the HES budget. And so I think that those cuts are going to come from someplace, and Hess's large portion of GF. And so that balancing act is something that we need to consider now when we're extending these out 2 years in which we have, by the administration, projected deficits. So I appreciate that.
Janet, so looking on page 2 of the fiscal note, if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that it's going to be about $7.2 million for 08, $7.3 for 09, $7.4 for 10, $7.5 for 11, and $7.6 for for 2012?
That's correct.
Okay, so we at least we kind of have an idea of what you're talking about. And yeah. It might probably be a good idea to ask, where does this go next, to finance? Yes. So it might be a good idea to ask them what they would like, or at least we've got it so that we can see what it is each year, but it would be nice to have in the original fiscal note. It just helps a little bit. Representative Roses.
On the second page of the financial statement, the line directly below your chart, where it says the FY08 governor's budget for the senior care component grant line is that $12,634,000? Is that correct? Is that what that is? Or is that $12,000?
That is $12 million, yes.
Okay. So what's that number represent? And how does it compare to this 7343 and the 7257?
Through the chair, Representative Roses, the $12,634.8, if you subtract the 7.25, 7.6, you get on front the 5377.2. So the current budget in the governor's budget is $12,634,800. It's made up of approximately $10.6 million in general funds and the rest from the senior care fund that has no money in it. And so when we're looking at what we put in the fiscal note, we were comparing to the governor's budget, thus the negative fiscal note, even though this bill does continue to cost money, and that the cost is outlined in the table on page 2.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. On page 2, line 4, you must be 65 years of age or older. When this senior care program originally came forward, it was if I recall correctly, it was kind of a transition to Medicare, or Medicare eligible age. And I'm wondering, you know, we were very careful in the retirement bill to specify Medicare eligible age, because Medicare eligible age may change. Is setting a year the appropriate thing to be here if this was transition between state and federal Medicare, or should this be Medicare eligible age, as we did in the retirement packages?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, my understanding, this is a state funded program. The state can set the rules. The current rules are 65. And so you could indeed change those to any other level, but as a cash benefit, it is a bit different than a Medicare health benefit.
Representative Seaton, do you have anything?
No, that was my only question.
Representative Fairclough?
Just wondering if we're ready to move the bill.
I'm ready.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move HB 148 from committee with a fiscal note that needs to be amended to reflect the exact costs to go forward to the Finance Committee and individual committee recommendations.
Okay, hearing no objection, so moved.
Madam Chair, just a quick question. If we want the amended fiscal note to go forward, will we then have to pass it when it's available?
No, because she included that in the...
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we could distribute it to committee members once we get it, because you'll have to have it before you can pass it on, correct, with that amendment?
Yep. Okay. Next is House Bill 136. House Bill 136, and that is our dental hygienist bill. You sure can. Representative Stoltz and one of his staff. I'll let you introduce.
Hello, Chairman Wilson and members of the committee. I'm Bill Stoltz. I represent House District 16, and with me is Ben Mulligan, my staff from the Palmer area, capable aide for me for now three or four years. Ms. Chairman Wilson, first I'd like to remark that this is my fifth year in the legislature and your fifth year of chairing this distinguished committee, and this is the first time the referral path has led me to be before you, and I don't know, it's taken a while to get here, and I'm glad our destiny has finally led a good bill to a good committee. So with that, I'll open my my very brief remarks and leave the bulk of the conversation and discussion to those who are more informed than me, which are a number of people that are going to be testifying. My interest in introducing House Bill 136 is twofold. One is I have occasion to probably know dental hygienists, and I see them in my district. They're an integral part of our business and professional community. So they brought the issue before me and explained the issues, why they wanted it presented to the legislature in the form that we have it, for their professional concerns to do the job that they feel that they can do, and probably even more importantly, the policy directive that really incited me to push the bill forward is the need to get preventative oral health care to areas that are currently unserved or vastly underserved. We've seen that through other practices of that are ancillary to the traditional licensed dental practice that have been embarked upon, and they're certainly not without contention from certain elements of the current profession license regime, and this may not be different in that regard, but I hope that we're able to address those concerns as they come up. I think that's probably the core of my testimony, and I could probably within about a 2-minute period, my staff can run through the bill just to get the guts of it, if that's
That's fine. And what my intentions are is to have you go ahead and explain the bill, and then listen to the testimony, and then we'll have our discussion. If there's questions, we can listen to them now, but try to keep it down a little bit till we hear the testimony. And then once we hear the testimony, then we can start asking questions and trying to do what we need to do. Okay, Ben?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Ben Mulligan, staff representative Bill Stoltz. There's three components to this bill. First is to allow a dental hygienist to place a filling into a cavity prepared by a licensed dentist. So while they would do the contouring and the fitting, the initial filling is actually prepared by the dentist. Second, it would authorize a licensed dental hygienist to administer local anesthetic agent under general supervision. Right now they have the authority to do it under direct and indirect. This would just expand their scope one step further. And then third, it would allow dental hygienists and dentists to enter into a collaborative agreement to allow them to go out and do some of the expanded functions that are listed in the bill to help with oral health care in Alaska.
Okay, thank you. And just so that the staff or the members of the committee know, indirect means that direct means that they have to be in the same room. Indirect means they have to be in the same building, and generally means that they have to be, under the auspice of a dentist. And is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Okay. And that was a question that I had when I was kind of studying the bill, because I wasn't sure what all those terms really actually meant. So,
Madam Chair.
Representative.
And I just to close, my 32 years of experience as a patient to the same dentist in Eagle River, and a fine man, and I haven't talked to him about the bill, but I think this would it's been reading through the bill and talking to him, it would also sanction a lot of things that are actually going on. The amount of time we know, much like the bulwark of the medical profession isn't the attending physician, it's the nurse and the nurse practitioner. And I certainly have found that in my just my anecdotal evidence as a patient, but the amount of time we see the dentist long after the you've spent a great deal of time, the dentist is in another room attending to other patients, which is an efficient way to do. They're certainly not in direct supervision, and it's, I think this is legitimizing what's really basically happening already in many cases as well. So with that, I'll not digress and let others who have less, probably more substantial than anecdotal evidence.
All right, and let's get some of the testimony that are off net. Delisa Culpepper, are you online?
I am.
Go ahead, Denise, and state your affiliation and oh, Delisa. Yeah. And go ahead.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Delisa Culpepper. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Alaska Trust Authority, Mental Health Trust Authority. And the trust has a long record of supporting effective strategies that increase access to all types of health care for our beneficiaries through appropriate use of professionals and paraprofessionals. And we believe that this bill is a good move in the direction of issues we have been involved in for the last couple years on access to dental care across Alaska for our beneficiaries. And we really are supportive of something that I think in statute dental hygienists have been doing for 30 years, the local anesthesia. I actually am a dental hygienist. I'm a practice for 18 years, but I was licensed when the first class of dental hygienists here in Alaska, the first year they licensed local anesthesia in 1976, and so they have 30 years of experience doing this under indirect and direct. I don't think it's been a problem. I think placing fillings in the prep is something that nationwide dental hygienists have done for years and has proven effective, and the collaborative agreements I think will certainly help us in addressing access to dental care in rural Alaska and other hub communities. So we are very supportive of this. We also, as co-chairs with the Rasmussen Foundation and the Alaska Dental Action Coalition, have been studying this issue, and the support has been very good for this bill, and we really urge your serious consideration and passage.
Okay, thank you very much. Sonia Hanforth-Cohn?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. My name is Sonia Hanforth-Combe. I am the executive director of the Iluluk Family and Health Services Clinic in Unalaska, Alaska. We're a freestanding 501c3 nonprofit or a community health center. We employ a dentist full-time. So I'm actually speaking to the concept of this more than the reality of it on the ground here in Unalaska. Prior to our having a full-time dentist, we had two part-time dentists that came to town, and a dental hygienist who lived in town and who, in fact, just a month ago moved away. And that dental hygienist who lived in our town was unable to provide any care to the thousands of patients out here, preventive or otherwise, because she didn't have... She didn't have a dentist in town. We had a dentist that would itinerate out about six times a year, and another one that would come out about four times a year. Now we have basically a full-time dentist here. He's here 45 weeks out of the year. And then we also have another two dentists that itinerate, again, that six times a year and four times a year. We don't have a dental hygienist because we haven't managed to hire one yet, but otherwise we would. But the other two dentists do, and again, given our population, they should be seeing more patients than they're seeing. But since they itinerate out of town, since they're not here all the time, those dental hygienists who do live on this island are unable to maintain continuity for those dentist patients. They're unable to do cleanings when the dentists aren't in town. They're unable to do a lot of the things that really they should be able to do. The mid-level concept for provider is very common in the medical arena, and it's not that great an extension to consider it, especially in rural areas, for the dental arena. It makes sense. It makes financial sense. It makes sense for profit or non for profit dentists, because for profit dentists can extend their practices that way, and not for profit as well. It's a very cost effective way of increasing access to dental care, getting people to have the habit of going to see their dentist for a cleaning, because they can anytime, not just when those dentists happen to be in town. And it will improve health outcomes, because because if people are seeing the dentist, it has been shown medically that their diabetes is in better control, their heart disease is in better control. So it has a impact that reaches out past dentistry into health outcomes that aren't traditionally associated with dentistry. And that is what I wanted to say.
Thank you very much, Sonia. And I don't see any questions, so we appreciate it. Vicki Hoff.
Hi, I'm Madam Chair and members of committee. For the record, my name is Vicki Hoff, and I'm speaking in support of House Bill 136. And I've spoken to many of you before, and I'd just like to reiterate the importance or the potential of this bill. And the minor additions to our scope of practice. We're still under the dentist. We're still directly supervised, so to speak, under the dentist. But now we're kind of able to go out and expand to people who need us. And in those ways, as written in the bill, excuse me, our general supervision for local anesthetics. Many times I've gone out to the village. I'm a public health hygienist working for South Central Foundation, and I do get to travel out to the villages. And many times I can go out there, but I have to turn patients away because either they need some deeper cleanings, and to do that comfortably, they need to be anesthetized. So I have to turn them away. Or another case would be where I'm out there and they haven't had an exam. Here again, my hands are tied and I'm unable to see these people. So even though I'm out there, I'm still incapable, as our statutes are written now, to provide any kind of care whatsoever. So consideration of this bill would be really helpful in providing many people oral health care. Any questions for me or anything?
Hey, thank you, Vicki. I don't see any hands raised.
Excellent.
Gail Walden. Gail Walden, are you online? You might be on mute. Okay, we'll go on to Jennifer McElroy.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee representatives. My name is Jennifer McElroy, and I'm a licensed dental hygienist in Soldotna, representing the Kenai Peninsula Dental Hygiene Association, as well as myself. We strongly support House Bill 136. And in working with community health, I see firsthand in rural areas the need for increased access to oral health care in regards to situations such as senior dental care. I see a complete lack of access. There are no dentists who visit nursing homes or group homes, even in communities such as Kenai and Soldotna that have a number of dentists, or even those communities that don't have local dentists. The licensed hygienists are the key oral health professionals that are able to deliver care in these nursing home settings. Some of these patients aren't able to go into a dental office. They don't have that capability physically or other access to go into an office. So having someone to be able to visit them and provide some of this care is extremely important. I've seen several of my patients personally that would benefit from having somebody in the nursing home or group home on a regular basis. In addition, it's a cost-effective solution to identifying these oral care issues. They affect overall oral health, total health as well. As far as many villages, Nikolaevis, Bosnesenka, Soldovia, other villages across the bay, and there's rural areas all over the state that need someone to have access on a consistent basis, and allowing hygienists to be able to perform their job out in these areas is a cost-effective solution. Dentists, there's only so many in the state, and there's only so many that can affordably go out to these villages or these areas, these cities. And I have some patients that travel from Solovia once a year. They're the lucky patients. Those patients that can't travel, that they have to take off several days to come in to see us in a community health setting, they don't get that care. And it's kind of a sad state to see that for kids, adults alike. Things as simple as daily brushing habits and teaching them good habits is so important. So in conclusion, I support strongly House Bill 136. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. Gail Walden, we're going to go back to you. Are you off mute now?
Are you there?
We are, and we can hear you.
We had some technical difficulties there.
Okay, go ahead, Gail.
Okay. As you said, my name is Gail Walden, and I am a licensed dental hygienist from Wasilla. I am a member of the Alaska State Dental Hygiene Association, and as you may have guessed, I strongly support the statute changes identified in House Bill 136. It represents many years of discussion, debate, research, and reflection upon the oral health needs of Alaska, Alaskans. The facts are that Alaskans are not being, the current oral health of Alaskans are not being met by the delivery system that's in operation today. Current statutes and regulations prevent dental hygienists from providing oral health care to the public in non-traditional settings. Dental hygienists receive a comprehensive education, are licensed and regulated by the state, and have mandatory continuing education and CPR requirements. Ultimately, hygienists are not being utilized to their full potential. Recently, the Alaska Board of Dental Examiners, which licenses and regulates dentists and dental hygienists, voted to support House Bill 136. They concluded that the proposed statute changes are consistent with the vision to ensure that all Alaskans receive the best possible care. We have also received support from the Oral Health Coalition and the Alaska Primary Care Association. I'll start with the local anesthesia statute change just to give you, as was stated earlier, it's been in the statutes for dental hygienists since 1981, and there has never been a disciplinary action taken against a hygienist for the administration of local anesthesia under the current statutes. As it was stated, that under general supervision, a dentist is still required to diagnose and treatment plan the patient, but just does not have to be present in the dental facility. Hygienists need and use local anesthesia to reduce stress and provide pain control in the treatment of moderate to advanced gum disease. The next one that I'll talk about is the restorative function license endorsement, which, of course, is to provide more clients with treatment in one day, especially as it was discussed in rural areas where dentists make a trip a month. Basically, they can see twice as many people, and it's been proven very effective in Washington, and it just needs to be implemented in Alaska is what we feel. And basically, in order for that to work effectively, you need one dentist, one hygienist, and two dental assistants. The dental assistants generally stay with the client during the whole treatment series. The hygienist generally gets the patient set in, takes the medical history and vital signs, and then numbs the patient for the dentist. The dentist comes in and preps the tooth while the hygienist moves on to the next room to numb the next patient. After the dentist has prepped the tooth, the hygienist comes in, and as it was stated, the hygienist puts the filling material in, carves it, contours it, and adjusts the occlusion as needed. So that's the restorative. As far as the collaborative agreement goes, we feel this has the potential to provide the greatest impact to Alaskan communities. The agreement can be specialized to the scenario. For example, in a school-based program, what would be included in that agreement would be triage, cleaning, sealants, and fluoride, or in some instances, just fluoride. It depends on the school program. It would allow hygienists access to nursing homes, homebound individuals, schools, Head Start programs, and communities where dentists are rarely, if at all, available. The intended benefit is just to reach individuals that are not receiving the care and provide preventive services to not only increase oral health, but general health and well-being. All of these statute changes, as it's been stated, have been initiated in other states and have proven to be safe and effective. All statutes show our continued professional commitment to working collaboratively with dentists. And I just ask for your support of House Bill 136.
Okay, thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Representative Stoltz.
Well, I just want to thank you for allowing the group that did testify. There was a much larger group that certainly wanted to, in deference to your schedule and just getting the most essential information. As you noticed, there was a coordinated effort from by region and by different areas of the bill. But the four speaking represent a much larger group supporting this. I just want to note that. But I hope we've been able to facilitate your timely consideration by exercising some efficiency and coordinating.
Okay, thank you very much. And we do have someone in the audience. David Logan. Is it Dr. David Logan?
Yes, yes.
come forward. State your name and your affiliation and then give us your testimony.
Representatives, my name is David Logan. I'm a dentist here in Juneau. I'm also a past president of the Alaska Board of Dental Examiners as well as a past president of the Alaska Dental Society. I'm speaking here today on behalf for the Alaska Dental Society. I'm currently the legislative chairman for the Alaska Dental Society. I'd like to speak today in support of the concept of increasing dental services in underserved areas, but at the same time I have to express some concerns about House Bill 136 and specifically one area that I'll address that we feel that should be removed from that bill for public safety. The Alaska Dental Society supports the addition of restorative functions for all qualified auxiliaries. We feel it should be available for both dental hygienists and dental assistants, not simply limited to dental hygienists. In most states that have adopted expanded duties, there's 18 states that have, all but one have expanded those duties for all auxiliaries. Only one state, Washington, currently limits it to dental hygienists. We also support allowing coronal polishing and scaling by all auxiliaries for all the states that have, it's generally considered in the dental nomenclature as expanded duties. For auxiliaries, they also have allowed that procedure, the coronal scaling and polishing by all auxiliaries. They kind of go hand in hand with the enhanced training necessary for these things. Generally, the addition of that is a small amount there, but it does a large amount for increasing the amount of services that can be delivered, especially in remote areas. We believe local anesthetics should remain under direct or indirect supervision. A provision of the medical and dental profession is first do no harm. This unfortunately goes against that. The level of training for hygienists is less than dentists for the delivery of anesthetic. The recognition of medical complications and the delivery of medical services as something untoward does happen. While the goal to increase treatment out in underserved areas is laudable, unfortunately these areas will also by nature tend to be remote and the furthest away from medical help if something does arise. Currently, there are no other states that are allowing general supervision of local anesthetic. It's either direct or indirect in every other state of the country. To put it bluntly, the procedures we're recommending be included in this bill are generally safe and they're reversible. If something is done incorrectly, it can be corrected. Unfortunately, with local anesthetic, it's one of the few ways in dentistry that you can actually kill a patient. Regarding the collaborative agreement, we feel all qualified auxiliaries that meet criteria set by the board should be able to provide some functions under the general supervision of a dentist out in the underserved areas. We would support coronal scaling and polishing, placement of temporary functions, restorations, collection of records as necessary for treatment, application of topical preventative agents. We feel by allowing that, that would do away with the necessity of developing a collaborative agreement. These functions could be done simply under general supervision. It would remove a layer of bureaucracy and avoid unnecessary costs for patients. These are safe procedures, do not require a dentist to render a diagnosis. The remaining provisions listed under House Bill 136, the removal of overhangs, root planing, or non-surgical periodontal therapy, the use of chemotherapeutic agents beyond the topical applications I discussed, those should be done after a dentist has assessed and diagnosed and treatment planned the patient. What separates a dentist from the remaining part of the dental team is the ability to diagnose and treatment plan a patient. Dental procedures can be taught in a piecemeal fashion. You can teach somebody how to scale teeth. You can teach somebody how to place a sealant on the teeth. The ability to diagnose and treatment plan, however, requires the ability to understand the entire oral structure, medical complications, and the interaction with the rest of the body. That's not so easily taught, and that's one of the reasons why medical school takes 2 years longer than hygiene school and the same amount of time as medical school. Procedures we recommend be included in 136 should be in place for all qualified auxiliaries. This will allow the increased delivery of dental services in underserved areas. The changes we are recommending are the changes that are safe for the public, procedures that are reversible in nature, and will not harm patients. For that reason, we encourage adopting these changes, but avoiding the proposed change to allow local anesthetic under general supervision. Be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, I have a question. The difference then, so what you're saying is let the dental assistant do all the same things that the dental hygienist does?
No, they certainly wouldn't. Ms. Chair, no, they certainly wouldn't be able to do the same thing. A coronal scale and polishing is simply what's above the gum line. What's below the gum line, that requires very specialized training, and that's where a hygienist comes in, or a dentist, or a periodontist, somebody who has that sort of advanced specialized training. But the removal of something that's above the gum tissue, no, that's a fairly general skill in the dental field and something that can be easily taught.
So the dental assistants are taught by the dentist, but the dental hygienists have to go out for 2 years of school?
For this limited aspect, yes, that would be correct.
Okay, and Representative Fairclough.
Thank you. Thank you for testifying today.
Thank you.
We received previous testimony on the safe practices for the past 30 years of anesthetic delivery by hygienists in the state of Alaska. Can you comment on that? Do you know of a case where a hygienist has caused harm?
I do not, through the chair, I do not specifically know of a case, no. However, there are, and by both dentists and hygienists nationally, there have been cases where there have been problems there. A greater percentage by dentists, but if you look at the volume of anesthetic delivered, dentists are astronomically above the volume of anesthetic delivered than hygienists are, so you would expect more on-toward direct actions from dentists.
Since
Representative Fairclough, you want?
Thank you, Madam Chair, please. Since it's going to require a collaborative effort, whose business license would be on the line if there was a mishap and there was a reaction to the anesthetic? Would the hygienist the insurance, or would the...
As I'm reading the legislation, under the collaborative agreement, there would probably be joint responsibility for both the dentist who has signed that agreement and the hygienist, and both would probably be liable at that. Now, whether a hygienist can get a business license in this state, that's a question I can't answer.
I wasn't looking for a business license. I was looking their professional license.
Oh, through the chair, I'm sorry, you said business license there. So, as far as the professional license goes, again, it would be circumstantial dependent, and that's something the board would have to investigate, but both licenses would likely be on the line.
Madam Chair, if I might
follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If it requires a collaborative agreement and your organization is in opposition, then I would assume no one would sign on as a collaborative dentist to supervise in a general way.
Through the chair, as we're hoping the legislation would be modified, it would do away for the need for a collaborative agreement. If, however, the legislation were to pass requiring a collaborative agreement for these actions to take place, I certainly can't speak for every dentist in the state. I have absolutely no idea who would sign on and who wouldn't. That's not a question I can even speculate on.
I want to follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My point is that you have a safeguard existing in the legislation as it stands today that someone has to be involved in the general administration, and so it's going to be up to an individual dentist to measure his relationship with an individual hygienist. So I think that there's a safeguard in there for the dental community, and so I'm just wondering, I understand that you're requesting us to take it out, but from my perspective, I see an advantage that if the hygienist is good, she'll be able to, or he'll be able to provide rural outreach, and if they're not, then they won't be able to find a dentist to enter into a collaborative agreement to have the general oversight from. And so it's perplexing to me to understand why dentists would be in opposition. It would be based on an individual recommendation.
Through the chair, I can only speak for myself on this matter, but I cannot imagine the circumstances that would have me enter into a collaborative agreement with somebody who was not under my employ. If I'm going to take the liability and that increased risk, then it has to be somebody who's working for me where I can control the actions, and in doing so ensure patient safety and at the same time also lessen my own exposure and risk.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Sisna.
I'm having a hard time figuring out how I'm going to ask this. In physical health, I think that's too close. In physical health, there have been for years in Alaska ways for people in the bush to get help through public health nurses. And the public health nurses have done just about anything and everything out there. And so we actually have been able to help people in rural Alaska quite a bit in a lot of health indicators. But the thing that separates, I think, huge numbers of people that I've seen in my 40 years here is teeth. And we lead the nation, I'm sure, in caries, and I've heard this, medevacs because of dental problems, because there hasn't been, for some reason, an attraction for dentists to get out to enough of rural Alaska to turn that around. We've got the dentists in our urban areas. We don't have them in our rural areas. And I had been told that it was likely that the dentists would be opposed to this. I think there's a moral responsibility when we have taken oaths for health to look out for and share the knowledge that we have. And in the previous question, there was a lack of wanting to associate, to work with, make an agreement with another professional, not as schooled, and in the physical health, in EMS, doctors, when there's a crisis, doctors are online and they give their say show. So even though the EMS workers are not only not employed by them, but they're volunteers, why would not your association work with or even come up with solutions that maybe isn't this solution? It's an embarrassment, I think, to the state that we haven't solved this problem.
Thank you, Representative Sisna. Representative Roses.
As I read through this bill, I had some of the same concerns that I heard you mention. But as you started speaking and you said that you wanted some of these, you felt like some of these provisions should be taken out, the removal of the marginal overhangs, use of the chemotherapeutic agents, and so on and so on. And if those were removed, those items that you mentioned, there were more in addition to what I just stated, that you didn't feel like this agreement would be necessary. That then indicates to me that the responsibility would fall entirely on the physician with whom they are working, since there is no collaborative agreement. So I think having the statement in about a collaborative agreement and then hearing you say that you personally would not sign on to that, I think that gives me the safeguard that I personally need to feel comfortable in moving this bill forward, because I
agree with Representative Sisna that many of the communities that could benefit from having this service provided, as stated in this bill, may not otherwise get that kind of treatment. And so with that being said, with reservations, I'm going to support this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, do I hear any other comments from the committee?
Is there any more testimony?
Is there anyone else that would like to testify that hasn't testified? Guess not. All right. Representative Fairclough.
Madam Chair, I move to move House Bill 136 out of committee. Is there a fiscal note anywhere in the packet?
Yes.
With the attached fiscal note and any individual recommendations.
Not hearing an objection, so move. Thank you. And now we will go, thank you, Representative Stoltz. And now we're going to go on to our next bill, and that is House Bill 159, Stillbirth Certificates, with Representative Gatto. Representative Gatto, do you want to come forward? Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, is it okay if I have my committee aide?
It sure is.
Intern from UAF help me out here.
All right, that would be fine. Are you going to introduce him?
I am. Madam Chair, committee members, the bill HB 159 really deals with moms and how they're treated with respect to stillborn babies. I've never known a mom who talked to me about a stillborn, except in the general way that they acknowledge the presence of one. However, the other thing I didn't know is there are whole organizations, for instance, the National Stillbirth Society Incorporated, which has deals with the situation and professionally is known as sudden antenatal death syndrome. Probably sounds a lot like SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. Antenatal death simply, sudden infant death means they have been born and died, usually in the crib. This one refers to being dying prior to being born. And what the bill asks is something fairly simple. I'm going to read you, if I can, this one paragraph here, because I think it sums it up quite clearly. We're asking for a certificate of birth. Now, most birth certificates say certificate of live birth, which by the very nature of using the word live in there to define what kind of birth there is, would indicate that there is a second kind of birth. So let me read. The issuance of a certificate of birth resulting in stillbirth does not impact in any way a woman's right to choose to terminate her pregnancy. Such certificates are issued only for deliveries following naturally occurring fetal deaths. Women who choose an elective termination of their pregnancy would neither be required to obtain a certificate of birth resulting in stillbirth, nor would they even be eligible for the reason that elective termination doesn't fall within the definition of a stillbirth. I think that pretty well sums up with my prior statement and with the definition, and we have people representing the organization who are online and will want to address this question also, and who make a profession of dealing with this. The National Stillbirth Society, founded in 2001, and we have Richard Olson, and he is the founder and executive director. I have personally been privileged to deliver about a dozen babies, and it's a joy. And I know there are some difficult births, but I've never experienced I have, and I almost neglect to say sometimes you go and it's a bad situation where there's a lot of bleeding and we hurry people to the hospital and we really don't find out much after that. But can I just tell a little story that's kind of fun?
Go ahead.
In this building, I don't know if you go to my office, there's a little picture on the thing there. And I delivered a baby, gosh, 25 years ago. And it turns out that baby was adopted and then adopted by one of the members who was here in the legislature. And that baby grew up, had her own baby, and our friend Cliff Stone is looking at the old birth certificates of his adopted child, and it says Carl Gatto, and he says, nah, can't be. But he knew it probably was. So he came to me, and since then, you know, I have the picture. I'm the grandpa now. So those are the live births. And the point is, they're a joy. They're a joy. But the other side of it is that joy is equally balanced by sheer devastation. And what these mothers can have through this legislation is just a certificate that says the child was born, even though stillborn. That's all it asks. You know, you're going to want to ask, does this have anything to do with Roe v. Wade? It doesn't.
Representative Roses?
You began your remarks by talking about a certificate of live birth. Would this one state a certificate
of birth?
Of birth, but not live birth.
Correct. Separate certificate.
Okay, then let me ask the following question then. And part of why I ask this is I realize this is a very sensitive issue, but I'm always looking for the unintended consequences of the actions that we perform. In the state of Alaska, a person qualifies for a permanent fund dividend, and all they have to do is show that they have a birth certificate for that individual. It doesn't say if they're born 1 minute before midnight, they qualify for that year. So what would happen in a scenario where there was issued a birth certificate and then immediately followed a death certificate?
That's a very interesting unintended consequence. I don't know.
Second question I would have.
I have to ask Sandra here because
Let me ask both questions. Second question I would have would be one along the lines of inheritance. I have seen trusts where there have been individuals that set up and said that their entire estate was going to go to their firstborn grandchild, because the surviving children financially wasn't an issue, so they left everything to the firstborn grandchild. If they were issued a birth certificate under that scenario, then they would have the inheritance, and then immediately upon their death, then it would then pass to whoever their surviving individuals would be, which would be the parents, which wasn't the intent of, you know, what went on before. So, you know, that's the only thing I worry about. The rest of this that you have proposed, the rest of the things you're talking about, I absolutely, you know, don't have a problem with, but those are the unintended consequences that I don't want to create something that's then going to create a quagmire later on down the road in terms of having people tied up in court deciding whether or not there was an inheritance issue over a stillbirth. That's my concern.
Through the chair.
Go ahead. State your name first.
My name is Sandra Wilson. I work for Representative Gatto. As far as the permanent fund goes, what this bill would do is give Vital Statistics the ability to issue a certificate resulting in stillbirth to the parents. It would not affect the child as to whether or not, because as it also states that they wouldn't be counted in live birth certificates. To be able to get the permanent fund, it also comes into, it has to be a live birth. It doesn't state that, but it's kind of followed along the precedence that would be. As far as your second question goes, I can't give you an exact answer on that. I don't know for sure. I can check it, but my guess would be that either they could put in a clause in a will or in the trust that they want to set up that says of live birth instead of stillbirth. But my guess is that it would also not, this would not affect that.
Well, if I may.
Representative.
Well, the reason I prefaced my concerns with asking the question on would this be, you know, where he had stated there would be a certificate of live birth. My specific question was, what would this one be? And the answer was a certificate of birth. Now, that's different than a certificate of stillbirth. I think if it says a certificate of stillbirth, I don't think these issues come into play because it was not considered to have been, you know, a viable living individual at the time of birth. So I don't think it would be an issue. So that, if it states that way, I don't have a concern. I don't think I do.
if I may, through the chair, the certificate would read birth certificate resulting in stillbirth. As it says at the beginning, you would get the regular, you know, you would get a birth certificate just like you do for, but where it says of live birth, it would say birth certificate resulting in stillbirth.
Okay, Representative Faircloth.
I was going to concur with Representative Rose's that the issue is still there. A birth certificate is issued, and there's a cause afterwards, or a quantitative factor that's entered into the record. Do we have someone online? Because I know that in the sponsor's statement that was very well prepared, I might add, Representative Gatto, I knew everything that you addressed us with because your staff and yourself presented a very, very nice packet for us, so thank you. But do we have anybody online with some experience, or preferably years of experience in other states, to speak to the concerns that Representative Roses has said?
Yeah, we do have someone here, actually. But let's go. Well, why don't you come on up? Philip Mitchell, why don't you come on up and you can kind of clarify this so there's no question at all.
Madam Chair, Philip Mitchell, Section Chief of the Bureau of Vital Statistics with Health and Social Services. And actually, I am here to testify in support of this bill, but I do have a few suggestions to make that would actually make it easier to administer and possibly or hopefully alleviate some of the concerns that I've heard here this afternoon. Typically, right now, when a stillborn occurs, if it's more than 20 weeks gestation, a fetal death certificate is completed for this particular fetal demise, and that's currently all we can offer the parents who've gone through this experience. And we have had some parents who've called us. They want to recognize the child. They want us to issue a birth certificate. Currently, however, our statutes only allow us to issue a live certificate of birth. And so we don't have anything to offer these parents, and you can hear in their voice that this has been a very emotional and a traumatic experience for them. And I really think that this type of a certificate could help them with the grieving process. With that said, the actual information we need to create this certificate of birth for a birth resulting in a stillbirth currently exists within the Bureau. All of that information is contained in the fetal death certificate. And I don't know if you have copies of our fetal death certificate and birth certificate in front of you. I did bring some if you would like to take a look at them. That may help explain what we're looking at here. I've got copies.
That would be great.
The top copy that you will be taking a look at is actually a certificate of live birth. And you can see some of the information that's included on the birth certificate. The items that are circled are typically the information that we put on a certified copy of birth that we issue from the Bureau. Also included would be the data sheet and the date file. If you look at the second page, here's a copy of the certificate of fetal death. It's kind of a combination death certificate, birth certificate. All of the information that's circled is very comparable to the certificate of live birth. So what we're actually proposing is that instead of creating a separate certificate and matching it up to the fetal death certificate, we would like to suggest amending Section F of the legislation. There's no reason for us to complete a separate certificate that's essentially going to duplicate information we already have. We would either suggest just deleting Section F or rewording it to say the certificate of birth resulting in stillbirth shall be prepared from information already contained in Bureau files or something like that. If we're creating this separate certificate and matching it up, all we're doing is duplicating work, and there's really no reason for us to do that. We could issue the certificate now if we have the authorization to do it.
I have a question. I know how traumatic this can be. I had a daughter that lost twins, but this was early on, and I know what she went through, so I can't imagine what it's like when someone carries a child close to 9 months or 9 months. It's just my little feeling that it would be nice to have a certificate. You know, you have the nice birth certificate, you know, and it would be kind of nice, even if it said stillborn, birth certificate. If it said it right on the certificate, then they would have something similar to the rest of their children if they have other children. And how hard would that be if you use the same information but just had a different certificate? And the only thing difference would be what kind of a certificate you gave them.
Madam Chair, we could do it now if we were authorized to do it. And I also note that this legislation gives us permission to prescribe the form and content of the certificate. And we have talked about this briefly within my staff, and I've talked to other states who have enacted this legislation. And they have, and we would also consider doing some type of a commemorative certificate instead of just the plain, ordinary, here's the something similar to a live certificate of birth, which is on security paper, but to do something more that may be a more commemorative type of certificate.
Okay. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. What about just using the certificate of live birth, but make it a certificate of stillbirth?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, we could do that, but again, we're creating a separate certificate, and the information we already have to issue certificate of birth resulting in stillbirth already exists within the Bureau. So why should we be duplicating our effort when what we really want to do is be authorized to issue this type of certificate, and we can do that with the information we currently already have on hand.
I'm sure, but I'm making a distinction, thank you, between a certificate of birth resulting in stillbirth and a certificate of stillbirth.
So Representative Gardner, through the chair, you are asking us to create a separate certificate that would say certificate of birth resulting in stillbirth and filing that in our files? Perhaps to me it seemed the intent of this legislation was to give us the authorization to issue a certificate of birth, not to necessarily create a new certificate.
Representative Faircloth.
Again, if we have someone online that has practical experience, I tend to...
We don't.
Well,
okay. And Madam Chair, I've checked with a few other states, and most of the other states are implementing this the same way, is that they're using information contained in the fetal death record to go ahead and issue this particular certified copy.
Well, follow-up, Representative Faircloth.
I appreciate the effort in mm-hmm. being conscientious about using dollars wisely and mm-hmm. not wanting to duplicate process. But the issue I think that's before us is the loss of a child to a parent in a grieving process. Mm-hmm. And at least this representative believes that if it's a second sheet of paper, that's okay. I understand that you want to do the commemorative, but if we change a live certificate to say stillbirth, it still doesn't recognize really that there was a life.
Yeah.
It says that we're recognizing the death, and what families who've experienced this tragedy are trying to tell us is there was life, and they want to recognize the life and understand that it's a two-step process. After life, there follows death, and they want to recognize it in that process versus making it easy for government, which, believe me, I do not like to fill out triplicate forms and enter the same information. So I would think that IT could actually manage to migrate the information over to the second form and kick two pieces of paper out. And if you understand what I mean, if it's the same information, it should be able to print on the second form straight away through. So I support a separate piece of paper that is indicating a life.
Okay, go ahead.
Just one additional comment along those lines, Representative Faircloth, through the chair. Also in Section G, it refers to a delayed certificate. To me, if we are using information off of the fetal death certificate, it wouldn't necessary for us to be taking the certificate and marking it delayed. That would alleviate that concern. I know that other states have this in their legislation, and I think this is really something that we need, is that something similar to that any parent may request that the Bureau prepare and issue a certificate of birth resulting in a stillbirth without regards to whether the fetal death occurred on or before or after the effective date of this act. And so by issuing off of that certificate, it would eliminate having us to put delayed on the certificate.
Yeah.
And it would also allow us to go back and look at our fetal death records and create the certificate without having to mark the record as delayed.
How many, in Alaska, how many deaths are there, still? How many stillborns are there in a year?
Madam Chair, the last 5 or 6 years has been on average about 50 per year.
50?
Yes.
Wow. Representative Fairclough.
Madam Chair, thank you. Do you have that in writing for us so that we can move an amendment? I think that that's wonderful that it would open it up so anyone that might still be in pain that wanted to honor their child in this way, that does that. So if you have that in writing.
I could give it in writing or write it down or.
I got any parent and then I'm just not the. I'm not the clerk that's doing such a great job getting it all down in one swift move. Thank you.
Sisna had a Representative Sisna, did you have a comment?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay.
I thought she raised her hand.
Okay.
I did.
Representative Gatto.
I had a staffer here last year who wrote me, and she said, thank you. She said, I was one of those people. I lost my first child at 32 weeks when I was 21, and she was given a death certificate to sign, and that was it. She said she was truly devastated 3 months later. In the grieving process, she really appreciates if she would have been able to get a second certificate that indicated that the death child must have been alive at some time to be given a death certificate, and she wanted that certificate.
I would think so. Mm-hmm. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I still share Representative Rose's concern, and I'm not certain that the workaround we have is legally what's going to resolve that.
If it says definitely like stillbirth on the certificate or something, then they could never use that to say, well, maybe they could they couldn't use it for the permanent fund because you have to have the birth certificate, but for some kind of a trust or something. Well, Representative Roses.
I want to speak a little bit to the, I mean, this is a devastating issue for anybody that's had to have gone through it. I've known some ladies that have, and it's awful. You know, so I'm aware of the sensitivity of this, and I hate to, you know, to argue the point because I don't want to diminish somebody's grieving process or their loss. But I think we almost have to go with two certificates if we do this, and here's why I'm thinking, and you can correct me, sir, because this is the area you work in. Are you required by law to issue a death certificate?
A death certificate is required to be created for anyone who does die in the state.
Okay. And are you required by law to also issue birth certificates, whether or not the parent requests one?
Representative Roses, through the chair, we are required to create a birth record as we are required to create a death record for anyone who was born or died in the state. We only issue one if a person or persons request a copy from us.
Okay, so then that was the question, because if I thought if you were required by law to create one, on this issue it says a person may request one. So if you're using the same form, you're going to be creating anyway. The only difference is you're going to give them a copy if they request it.
That is correct, Representative Roses, through the chair. And I know that a lot of people have different grieving processes that they go through. Some of the infants on a fetal death certificate are unnamed. Some parents do name them, and I think that suggests maybe perhaps a more emotional attachment in that particular case. And so I'm sure some parents will not want to take advantage of this, and there are others who will.
I'd like to follow up.
Follow up, Representative Rose.
And looking at these two certificates, mm-hmm. certificate of live birth and certificate of fetal death, the two major differences that I see in the top part of the information is on one it says child's name, on the other it says fetus name. And on one it says date of birth, on the other it says date of delivery. On the certificate of fetal death, it says date of delivery as opposed to date of birth.
That is correct, because currently a stillborn infant is not recognized as being born live. And that's why it's just the date of delivery. And so on a certificate of birth resulting in stillborn, we would not have the date of birth, we would have the date of delivery.
So if this certificate were to be retitled where it says certificate of fetal death or stillbirth, would you then be able to change date of delivery to date of birth, and then that would be followed by the cause of death? Or the death certificate that's in the second part? I mean, I'm just procedurally trying to look at how you would do this if you were going to have one form as opposed to two.
Representative Roses, through the chair, what I was proposing is not to create another certificate, but to use this information to create the certificate that the parents would request from us. I think you were asking about, could we use this to create a new certificate and keep that in case the parents asked us for a copy of that birth. Is that correct?
Well, actually, the way I worded the question, you're right. It's two separate questions. So I guess the first one would be, what would be the disadvantage of making the change, as I described, to call it a certificate of fetal death or stillbirth?
Oh, you mean you're going to, at the top, it's going to say a fetal death or stillbirth?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And then you'd change date of delivery to date of birth. I mean, I don't know. I'm just asking.
Representative Gatto first, and then do you want to make a comment, Representative Gatto?
I do. The purpose of this is not to do clerical and accounting. We already have that, and we can modify that, and I'm sure the department can do that. The purpose of this is to deal with the mother who wants a certificate. And if we start doctoring the certificate of death, she has that. She already has it. What she wants is something different. And that's what we're trying to give her. Now, I'm not in favor of modifying the death certificate. Please, I want that left alone. What I want to do is give her something else. And that is something to hold on to. Now, the legal parts of that, whether she can take it to the IRS and claim a deduction, whether she gets a permanent fund, whether somebody gets an inheritance, is interesting. So let's make it so that it doesn't allow that. But she still should get a certificate of birth resulting in a stillborn. Otherwise, we haven't resolved the reason we're here.
Okay.
Representative Faircloth?
Madam Chair, that's exactly where I was going. The family that's grieving is wanting a two-step process. They want to recognize that they had a child and that that child lived.
Well, we have one more person online, and I was told later looks like this person just said they were there representing themselves, but since then I have heard that this person has been involved in this legislation in Florida, I believe. So, Daryl Ogolo?
It's Lagulo, thank you.
Thank you, sorry about that. Go ahead, Daryl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I want to thank you for this very important legislation and urge you to support 159. My name is Daryl Lagulo. I'm a volunteer with the MIS Foundation. The MIS Foundation works nationally to educate people on the tragedy of stillbirth. I also helped recently create the law in my state, Florida, which is where I'm calling you from this afternoon. But more importantly than that, I'm a bereaved father, and I'd like to tell all of you a story. I'd like to tell you about people in your state that we hear from that say this legislation is so very important. You see, it was back in 2005 on Mother's Day, of all days, that my wife was 8 months pregnant. Now, I want you to imagine expecting your second child and learning that all of a sudden your wife isn't feeling anything. Now, I, as a good husband and father, told my wife she was probably tired because we spent the whole day together with our family celebrating Mother's Day. Plus, just 2 days before that, on Friday, May 5th of 2005, we had just been to our OB for a routine 35-week checkup, and everything was fine. But suddenly that morning, Beth, my wife, got worried because my daughter, 8 months pregnant, 8 months with my wife, you know, motherly instinct kind of took over. My wife, that morning, that Monday, May 9th, drove herself very courageously to the hospital, and I rushed to be by her side and watched her get hooked up to various fetal monitors. In just a matter of minutes, that excellent prenatal checkup that we had with her doctor 2 days before, we learned that our baby girl's heart was no longer beating. For no medical reason whatsoever, 3 separate OBs came into the room and confirmed our worst fear, much like they do in your state, that our daughter, who was going to be born in just some 4 weeks, had died. Now, I want to mention to you that during this pregnancy, my wife never drank alcohol. She did not smoke. She no way endangered our daughter. She followed our doctor's advice at every way. She did all the right things. But despite those right things, my daughter was now dead. And, well, we checked into the hospital and we watched as the doctor induced my wife. 18 hours of traumatizing physical childbirth with my wife battling the sea of emotions to deliver our child on Tuesday, May 10th. A beautiful 5-pound daughter. We said she was sleeping and still, and she was. I want to mention to you some things that have been mentioned today about 159. First of all, I want you to ask yourself, is what you just heard any different than what any woman goes through to deliver a healthy living child? It clearly is not. The physical act of birth is exactly the same. In stillbirth protocols, in the medical courtesies that are given to people and that I've heard of across the country, say that people get mementos like crib cards, or in our case, we were given our daughter's wrist and ankle bands, or we were even given her handprints. But you see, parents and parents in your state check out of the hospital with broken arms, empty arms, and broken hearts and wounds. Can you see how easy it is that any tangible item could be considered essential in the bereavement process? There's birth, and yet in your state you recognize death, the fetal death certificate. But I ask you, how can you have death without life? You can't. You just heard that your state provides a final disposition, a fetal death certificate. The most perfect case to insult to injury is slapping the parent by issuing them the fetal death certificate without telling them that the birth occurred. This is wrong, and it needs to change. In fact, it is changing, and it's changing across the country. Just this past week, South Dakota became the 16th state, or the, beg your pardon, the 15th state in the country to pass meaningful legislation. Back to my point about the death certificate and the fetal death records. You know, birth is a process. Life or death is an outcome. To no fault of the woman, to no fault of my wife, to no fault to other women in your state, did they choose this. But yeah, we want to put them on their way. We want to send them home and forget about this. We want to say to them, you know what? Let's just go ahead and issue a commemorative certificate. With all due respect to who mentioned that earlier, there was nothing commemorative about this birth. In fact, not issuing this document, some could suggest, is discriminating against the woman. Because the physical act and the trauma that she went through to deliver that child is exactly identical that she went through to deliver her living child. To the point that was mentioned about the definition and changing this to a certificate of stillbirth, I would strongly suggest that you be opposed to that. The definition of stillbirth is the birth of a dead child. Yet you already issue a certificate of stillbirth. You probably don't realize it, but it is a fetal death certificate. People of your state, as Representative Gatto is pointing out, do not want a second death certificate. They want a certificate of birth, those three words, to recognize what the woman went through. Nothing more, nothing less. A certificate of birth, those three words, resulting in stillbirth. Not a combination of documents. Not amending the language, not doing something now so that it can be done quickly, so that we don't duplicate efforts. Can you imagine how far-reaching this can be to people that are out there in your state that are hurting right now? Let me conclude by saying that the women that you won't hear from, and the fathers that you won't hear from, that have not been able to get past this, who are not speaking to you today, they're living with a broken cradle, with shattered lives in a world that shuns them because people just don't know what to say. And the death of a child, your grandchild, is among the worst of all deaths. And one of my friends told me once, he said, you know, you bury your parents or your grandparents. You're not supposed to bury your children. I'm asking you to support 159. It's called the Missing Angels Bill. It allows parents that lose a child after 20 weeks of gestation to request a certificate of birth resulting in stillbirth. Please allow this bill to move forward. Please vote yes on this. Please acknowledge these women. Please acknowledge the children as well.
Thank you, Darrell.
Thank you, Madam.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you. Thank you, Darrell. I've been advocating your position here for a little while, but Representative Roses and Representative Gardner raise an issue that is worthy of discussion. Do you have any insight into how long legislation in other states that have already adopted a live birth certificate or a birth certificate, if they faced any challenges or what they've done? Can you give me any historical information that's not provided with us today?
What I can tell you is most states have made this an optional document where they've where there has been issues where people have wanted to trump this for other political agendas. I heard issues of pro-choice and pro-life mentioned. This is not what this bill is about. This bill is the right thing to do. It's not a right to life or right to choose. So to your question, making it an optional certificate, the state is not mandating this document on anyone, but we're allowing it to be provided to help in the bereavement process. Second point, I heard it mentioned that the document be printed with, this is not proof of live birth. There were issues mentioned earlier about inheritance and transference, I heard. I think if that document was clearly printed, as in the case of the state of Texas and my state, the state of Florida, where on the document it says this is not proof of live birth, that squashes that concern completely. Thirdly, we strongly encourage a retroactive provision. Can you imagine the healing and the hope and the help this will bring a woman from 20 years ago in your state? I can tell you today, just today, I received word from a woman in the 1960s because my great state made this a retroactive provision dating all the way back to when fetal death records were kept in our state. Please allow that to happen. Those are three very important points.
Thank you, Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Darrell, I appreciate your testimony and you sharing your personal story. Thank you very much. I don't want to speak for everyone here, but we hear your pain and we certainly want to respond to that for Alaskans. But we are going to have a discussion that's political, and I don't think anyone is having a discussion around pro-life or pro-choice, but only in administering the certificate so that it meets the needs of grieving families and that it addresses any concerns that might be before us. But I so appreciate your testimony and bringing this to the attention of Representative Gatto, and Representative Gatto in turn bringing that to the Health and Education, the HESS Committee today. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we don't have too much time left, and there is one more person to testify. Richard Olson from the National Stillbirth Association. He just came online not too long ago. So, Richard, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Let us hear your testimony.
I'll make it short, and I'll make it unemotional as I can. You've heard the heartfelt pain of a father who honored his child and his wife by doing an exceptional job in Florida of getting that passed. You know, Florida is a state that can go either way, but Utah passed it, and it's very conservative, and Massachusetts passed it without objection, and it's very liberal. The point was made, it's not an issue of choice, it's not an issue of life. It's an issue of recognition for what has transpired. As the gentleman said to you, it is recognition that an event occurred. Right now, if a woman has twins and one is born still and one is born live, there is no certificate acknowledging the birth of the still baby. So still or live is an outcome, and a woman should not be penalized because she did the same thing on each twin. One just happened to be born still. My own personal story is real simple. I was 60 years old. I'm now 67. My wife at the time was 38. We lost our only child that she's ever had and I've ever had. Camille Rihanna Olson was stillborn at 41 weeks. She was kicking the night before. She was dead the next morning when we went to have her delivered. We joined hands with Joanne Cacciatore, who is one of the most outstanding women I know, and she formed an organization called the Miss Foundation, and she had lost a daughter. And when she went to get a certificate of birth, as she had done for her three prior children, she was told by the county recorder or whoever was handing this thing out that she had not given birth. Well, being a mild-mannered Italian housewife, this didn't sit too well with her. And the woman behind the counter said, well, I'm terribly sorry. That was a very, very awkward thing for me to say. Of course you gave birth. You just didn't have a baby. You had a fetus. That's horrible. That's absolutely horrible. Until about 2 years ago, March of Dimes on their website said the worst thing that can happen is for a woman to learn that her fetus has died. Folks, I don't know anybody's ever seen a book at the checkout counter, 1001 Names for Your Fetus. It's called 1001 Names for Your Baby. That's how we regard them. They're babies. The fact that they're not live babies, you know, doesn't make them any less of babies. We are not looking for personhood for our babies at all, as Mr. Neville's explained. We're not looking for personhood. We're just looking for acknowledgement for our lives, but for our future as well. Today in the United States, if today was a typical day, 80 babies were born dead, okay? One out of every 116 deliveries is a dead baby. This is not a lifestyle issue. As Mr. Neville's pointed out, his wife did everything right. As I can point out, my wife did everything right. You know, there's an undercurrent where people believe that it's somebody who used drugs or used alcohol or somehow did something inappropriate. Folks, if you do that, you're going to lose the baby to a spontaneous abortion in the first trimester. When you get to the third trimester, there's virtually nothing a woman can do that can intentionally cause the death of her baby. So, you know, there are about 30 different reasons why women have stillbirth, and 29 of them account for about 30 to 40% of the stillbirths. Then the rest of us have exactly what we had, a certificate that says, you know, autopsy certificate says cause of death unknown. The only way we're going to get past this great unknown is if enough people are aware of it. And just the fact that you ladies and gentlemen are considering this bill today has raised the awareness level within the Arizona legislature for the issue of stillbirth and the crying need to do something about it. There are 30,000, 26,000, 28,000, you know, they're always late in reporting numbers, stillbirths in the United States every year. And in the last reporting year, there were about 2,300 SIDS deaths, crib deaths, sudden infant syndrome. And you see ads about that. You see discussion about that. Okay? Truly, 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 stillbirth is the great elephant in the middle of the living room floor that nobody talks about. When my baby died, I looked for an activist group to join. Finding none, and I said activist, not, you know, sympathy group, finding none, I founded the National Stillbirth Society. And today, it is the third largest it comes in third on Google if you Google the word stillbirth. We're number three on the list after the March of Dimes and Wikipedia. This has grown to enormous proportions. It's an indication of the extent of interest and also the extent of pain. We estimate there are over 1 million women in the United States living today who at some point in their lives lost a baby to stillbirth. You would be making an incredibly humane and compassionate decision by supporting this bill. And I conclude my remarks with a request for any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you, Richard. I'm going to close public testimony, that's right. And then what I'm going to do right now is I think that there's a couple legitimate things here that maybe we could look at. I'm looking at, I can't see why we have to have two different death certificates. I'm thinking that you could take a place on here somewhere and just add a spot and said, was this a stillbirth? And then that's all you'd have to do, and you wouldn't have to do anything else, you know, so that, because they're already going to get a death certificate, and that's what you didn't want to, because you were concerned about F, where it says you have to file the certificate of birth resulting in stillbirth with the fetal death certificate.
Right, which is good. Madam Chair, essentially have the same information that's on the certificate.
And so you could change this, and that wouldn't change. But we still need to have a certificate. I think it's very important that the woman have some kind, or the family. Husbands feel about this too. I've got a concern for the whole family. And so I think they have to have some kind of a certificate so that they've got something to look at once in a while and to feel comfortable with and stuff like that. So Representative Gatto, what are your feelings here?
In your packet, you have a copy from Indiana. The certificate of birth resulting in stillbirth is the title. Okay, it's with the National Stillbirth Society letter. And interestingly, Iowa simply has a certificate of stillbirth. And that's all they have. To me, that was pretty clear. It doesn't say birth resulting in or anything like that. And it's probably something that we could certainly look at.
So I'm not going to pass the bill out today and think that you can try to work on some other things. And we have some other people that would like to make some comments. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have in front of us something entitled Bill Analysis and from State of Alaska 2006 Legislative Session. I can't really tell who it came from. It makes a couple of references to certificate of stillbirth. It came from you?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm a little...
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, we use the term stillbirth and fetal demise synonymously.
Uh-huh.
It's for any, maybe perhaps call it for any delivery for a gestational period of 20 weeks or more. Stillbirth, fetal demise, those two terms are used synonymously.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and follow up, I'm still puzzled about this particular document because the first line of within the box says continued from page one, and the bottom says page two of two, and I'm just sort of curious what's on page one.
Representative Gardner, through the chair. Yeah. Actually, the information that was only supposed to be copied, this was under amendments proposed.
I see.
And it was for the my recommended was to amend Section G to read, any parent may request that the Bureau prepare.
I see.
That was to get to the retroactive part of it and to eliminate having to have delayed printed on the certificate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'm missing that page.
No. We didn't pass out the first page. This is just the terminology right down here. This is all.
It was only to get the terminology in the amendment.
And I really think that that's very good, because I've got a feeling that when people hear about it that have had trouble going through the grieving process, there you will be flooded at first with several requests. And so I think this is wonderful that we can go back and pick that up. It gives me goosebumps right now, because I just feel like it will help people, some people that have had a hard time going through the grieving process. This might help complete that process. So Representative Roses.
The concern that I had voiced earlier, I think, would be taken care of. The last testimony that we heard, you know, sort of gave me some relief as to how I think we can handle this. But from what I heard from the majority of the people testifying, they don't want this to say it's a certificate of stillbirth. They already have that with a death certificate. What they're asking for is a certificate of birth. And the concern I had was the way in which that could be used. But the testimony of the last individual that spoke mentioned two states in which somewhere on that certificate, it clearly states that this is not proof of live birth. And I think if that certificate stated that, then that would prevent someone from using that in a legal manner to try to indicate, either through inheritance or for right of survivorships or any other thing, that that could not be used in that capacity. So if I had some assurance that that was on the certificate, I would be 100% supportive of this. This is a very emotional issue. I'm supportive of the concept from the very beginning. I've never been against this. I was just against the unintended consequences, and I think this, for me, would solve that problem, and I would be very supportive of the bill.
Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 2, line 5, it does address that. Representative Roses, the department shall prescribe the form and content of a certificate of birth resulting in the stillbirth record. So the administration can do that. I would like to offer an amendment. I'd like to offer
Amendment
J.
Number 1.
It's amendment number 1. And I'd like a new item J that says, any parent may request that the Bureau prepare and issue a certificate of birth resulting in stillbirth without regard to whether the fetal death occurred on or before, comma, or after the effective date of this act. I think that that was an excellent point.
Okay. Hearing no objection, the amendment has passed. Anything else? What I'd like to do then is have you guys work on some of the other terminology in the bill and come back next time. And so then we'll have a CS so that you guys can, then we can look at it. We can bring that roll this amendment into your next one. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, and Madam Chair, I'd still like some kind of legal assurance that there wouldn't be inheritance issues or something along those lines.
Maybe they could do some research in the meantime. Okay, thank you, and having said that, this meeting is adjourned. Okay.